Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 55184, DeCastro v. State. Mr. Ames for the appellant, Ms. Holtz for the respondent. Mr. Ames.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Cesar Almasi, 7974. With the Court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
And I had planned on focusing first on four assignments of error, going to the trial court's decision to limit the defense theory of the case, presentation of the case.
Counsel, I might tell you, I know the three of us always discuss these cases before, and I know we all have an interest in this neighbor issue, you know, like that, what did the neighbor know and or didn't know, and how that the neighbor was selected on the jury. So if you could devote some time to that, we would appreciate it.
I will. Beginning with that, Justice Cherry, there was evidence that the neighbor had said that he lived there on the street. Defense counsel, James Ruggieroli, heard him say that from 20 feet away in the presence of the other jurors. And although the lower court stated and admonished him not to go to that area, not to go to the neighbor's, not to go to appellant's house, and not to mention it to the juror, we believe that that was insufficient.
Well, how far did the record develop how close he was to the house where the appellant lived and all?
Unfortunately, that was not on the record. There was
It could be Charleston Boulevard, you know, it could be, I don't know what this, you know, I mean, that's an illustration. It could be a big street and a lot of distance here, so I'm just curious about that.
In all fairness, from the transcript, it appeared that it was in close proximity. I can't say that it was next door. I certainly can't say that it was a great distance up as in Charleston Boulevard, but it was close enough that it resonated with that juror that, hey, that's by my house. This is in my neighborhood.
Okay.
And certainly there is a case of implied bias there. The person had indicated, the juror had indicated that he had children. There were statements made during the interviews in which questioning the appellant regarding other victims, other potential victims there. Certainly, as a parent, he's going to have some bias there. He's going to be interested in whether, oh my goodness, this person lives here down the street from me and he's snatching kids off the street. And that was actually how it was put by the detective. Detective Spencer said to him, well, you're not the kind of guy who's going to snatch kids off the street. But it was a question that certainly would have resonated with that juror. Mm-hmm. And so a very strong claim of implied bias there.
Okay.
With regard to those four assignments of error.
And what was requested in the way of a remedy in the trial court? A mistrial or elevation of one of the alternates to take the place of the juror who lived on the street?
That's
both,
correct,
all of the above, none of the above?
The first request was that he be removed and an alternate juror be put on the panel. And this was well into the trial, but the alternate juror, by all indications, was ready and available to take the place of that juror. And then once that was denied.
So there were alternates remaining?
Correct. Correct. And once that was denied, and defense counsel mentioned on the record that he heard the jurors state in the panel with the other jurors present that he lived on that same street, he moved for mistrial at that point. And certainly that is an extreme remedy. But here, where a person's due process rights are at stake, and this court, as well as the United States Supreme Court, has stated when there's an indication of implied bias such that in a close case, and certainly this was a close case, two of the five counts were dismissed, where he was found not guilty, that bias, that implied bias, is going to be an issue.
And what you're suggesting is that the juror was personally threatened by having a man accused of pedophilia as a neighbor.
Correct.
And that personalized that bias by bringing it to his home, in essence.
The other point that I think is worth mentioning here is that if that fact had come out through voir dire of this particular juror when they were impaneling the jury, that certainly would have been cause to challenge for cause there, that particular juror. So I think it stands to reason here that because of that, once it came to light, he certainly should have been taken off the jury.
But in the voir dire process, I would doubt if they probably just would ask you to know any of these people. I don't recall them ever going into street addresses or things like that. So it's not a normal subject for voir dire jury selection.
Well, I know from my own personal limited experience with trials that sometimes addresses are mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The facts are going to show that this address, that this incident occurred here, that this person lives at this address, just to ensure that there is no personal connection to any of those places or to the people who are living there. That doesn't appear to have happened here. Once that came to light, if it had come to light during the voir dire, that would have been cause to challenge that juror or that implied bias. With regard to the assignments of error in which the court didn't allow full presentation of the case, there are four. And the court denied an oral motion to continue, thereby precluding testimony from a Lillian DeCastro. Lillian DeCastro is the mother, the aunt of the complaining witness here. She's also the sister of Marvin Kabiling, who testified at trial on behalf of these allegations. They were embroiled in a custody dispute at the very same time. And in fact, these allegations came to light right in the middle of this custody dispute. And Lillian Kabiling would have, DeCastro would have been available to testify regarding his bias. And these four assignments of error speak to that bias. And this court, as well as the United States Supreme Court, has stated where there's evidence going to a witness's bias, the defense should be given full opportunity to explore that bias. There was no one else that was situated as Lillian DeCastro to testify about the custody dispute. She would have offered evidence of his bias and impeached him directly regarding four different points. There was some question about the wife's cause of death, the guardianship agreement, where he stated that his signature was forged, and that Lillian DeCastro had taken the complaining witness without his permission. That, on its face, appears to be credibility issues, but in fact, it's biased because his argument in the custody dispute was that he was a more fit person to have custody of Mary Lou Kabiling, the complaining witness here. Any evidence of that, any evidence going towards his unfitness or his position there is imputed bias here in this case, his motive to lie, his motive to fabricate these allegations. The second error by the court has to do with the denial of the investigator to testify regarding Lillian DeCastro's statements. Now, she was certainly unavailable under the statute, NRS 50.085, Section 3. She just had cancer surgery the week before trial was to start. Defense counsel only learned the day before the start of trial that she was going to be too ill to testify, certainly qualifying as a then-existing physical infirmity. Going from there to, that was 51055C. Going from there to NRS 51315, those statements to the investigator were subject to that exception under the residual hearsay. It was made under special circumstances. Those statements would have been in line with and consistent with documents that were presented in the custody of determination, therefore having an indicia of reliability. And also, these weren't necessarily factual assertions that she had made to the investigator. They were her impressions and her position as the countervailing person in that custody dispute. Third assignment of error is that the documents, court documents, weren't allowed. She had, there were affidavits by Lillian DeCastro that had been submitted in the custody determination that this lower court had prevented from being admitted, and also a written document purportedly written by or authored by Marvin Kabiling, where he stated that the mother of the complaining witness had died in a car accident. Again, on its face, it looks like it had to do with his credibility. But here, the Lobato case is instructive. I would ask the court to take a look at Lobato. That's 120 Nevada 512, because I feel the situation is on all fours with that case. The analysis there has to do with the bias and 50.085. It was error for the lower court. This court decided that it was error for the lower court to exclude certain evidence of the bias of the state's witness. Certainly on its face, it looked like it was a credibility issue, but delving further, it was bias. And that's what we have here. Marvin Kabiling's bias in fabricating these allegations, the effect it would have had in the custody determination, and the fact that it occurred here as well, giving rise to this case.
Could you elaborate on that? I don't understand that argument. I don't understand what the significance was of a questionable out-of-court statement regarding the cause of death of his of this child's mother years before in 1992. Why does it matter?
He's arguing in the custody case that he's the more fit person to have custody of Mary Lou Cabilling. And if it can be shown in that custody case that he in fact fabricated the cause of death for whatever reason, whether it was monetary gain or simply to...
So he lied is the point of that?
Correct.
And why is that bias as opposed to credibility?
Because it attacks his character. There is a question of whether he's a fit person to have custody in that determination in the court proceeding, the custody proceeding. And so the bias there is the same bias that was in Lobato. In that case, it was a state's witness who testified that the defendant had made statements against interest, had bragged about the killings that took place there. But in fact, that witness had perpetrated a fraud on her sentence in court and produced letters that were forged, and that went on its surface to credibility and her truthfulness. However, this court ruled that that was also evidence of her bias.
I get the connection in that case, but I'm having trouble making it on the husband's attribution of a long-deceased wife's death to car accident as opposed to aneurysm or aneurysm as to car accident, whichever way it went.
Right.
If indeed he ever made that statement, and that's a whole other...
Yes. If it had been shown that he, in fact, fabricated, or if at least the argument could have been made to the jury that he had fabricated her death, or there's a question about his truthfulness, then that would have brought into question whether he was a fit person to have custody of his child. And it goes to his motive to lie about...
But neither one of those scenarios would suggest that he killed his ex-wife.
No. And that was not, certainly not.
So you're just saying because he lied about the cause of death of his, perhaps because he didn't want to discuss it.
Whatever the reason for that fabrication or that particular instance where he stated that it was a car accident, not aneurysm, I believe the truth was that she had died during childbirth because of an aneurysm,
yeah.
Correct. Very tragic. But it goes to his character, his ability to be a fit person. And so his motive to lie here in this case, which these allegations in a sense help put him over the top in the custody determination, or at least that's what the argument would have been. I see I've got about 2.5 minutes, so I'll reserve that for a moment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Holthus, on behalf of the state of Nevada.
Thank you. May it please the court. I guess I'll go right into the neighbor issue, Justice Gibbons being concerned. We're using the term neighbor. That wasn't the actual neighbor. Infers there's some camaraderie, there's some familiarity, there's something else going on. What the juror actually passed the note during Detective Spencer's testimony was, this is the first time I've seen an address for this event. I live at 7809 Lovely Pine Place, which is the same street, I guess, as the defendants. I have never had contact that I know of with any person I have seen during these proceedings. That was the sum and substance of the note. Against a backdrop of extensive voir dire, can you be fair and impartial, bring to the court anything that you think needs to be brought to the court? Clearly he brought to the court what he felt. He explained that it really had no impact on him, and he was left in the discretion of the trial court, admonished appropriately, and no bias, either expressed or implied bias, has been shown. The testimony of Detective Spencer was absolutely contrary to what is briefed here. He wasn't saying he's some pedophile, he's grabbing kids off the street. What he was saying to him was, in contrast to the pedophile, it's not like you grab kids off the street. This is a crime of opportunity, i.e. Juror Blackman, your kid's never at risk. There's nothing going on. This is simply something where the child was in the home, and that was a distinction being drawn, having nothing to do with anybody down the street being concerned about him. No implied bias shown, therefore the discretion of the court should stand, and that should not be a basis to do anything in this case, because it simply hasn't been shown. There was ample
Could you address your opposing colleague's point that has been elicited during voir dire, there would have been grounds for a for-cause challenge of this juror?
It would have been, I disagree that it would be for-cause. I mean, I think based upon the record that we have, he would have said, does this affect your ability to be fair and impartial? No, I mean, they took an oath. If something arises that you feel will affect your ability to be unfair or impartial, then you need to bring it to the court's attention. Clearly, this juror was abiding by his oath. He was following instructions. He brought to the court's attention what he felt was appropriate, the fact that this address rang a bell. We can infer that he would have, if this would have impacted him, then he would have brought that to the court's attention. What would have, based upon the record we have, happened in that circumstance is I would have said, does that cause you to be unfair? Can you not give him a fair trial? He would have said no. Maybe they would have exercised a preempt. I mean, I'll give you that. I can't stand for that. But you don't have a right to that. I mean, there's a lot of information that may have caused preempts to be exercised that never are. But in terms of changing the outcome, nothing in the record indicates that sufficient to, I mean, undo a whole trial, quite frankly. There's nothing, and while I'm at that, this wasn't a close case. I'm not sure. This was a case in which the defendant admits to the police in a fully briefed and fully argued and fully addressed confession that he kissed her breast, he kissed her on the mouth, and he did snip her vagina. So, I mean, it's not like we just had this kid coming forward in a custody battle making some off-the-chain kinds of allegations. We had her saying this and the defendant saying, yes, I'm sorry, I'm ashamed, it's causing me to drink a lot, I'm thinking about taking my own life as a result of what I've done.
Could you address his Miranda issue? I mean, the August 30th interrogation, he was interrogated twice, right?
I say he was questioned on the 30th. Detective Spencer goes to his home, say there's some allegations, can we talk? We had a full-on hearing. Everybody testified, including the defendant, and it was simply non-custodial. There was nothing in the record to suggest that he was in custody. Detective Spencer went to his house. Hey, do you want to talk about this? Yes, I do. They sat at the kitchen table. They had a cordial conversation. Apparently, the defendant liked it real hot, and so Detective Spencer got a little bit uncomfortable and said, you know, can we finish this some other time? He went down to the station. In the course of that, he decided he would just go arrest him, arrested him, then brought him to the... But he had already made his
statements. He was Mirandized before the second...
Correct.
...questioning.
He was clearly in custody and arrested before the second one, but he was Mirandized. But any statements had been made prior at the voluntary statement. And there was really no issue. The court didn't really have a problem. I think the defendant was kind of thrown up. I don't really understand, but there was various documentation written by him in English. It was kind of one of those... The court clearly found that he had an adequate understanding of the English language, having reviewed the whole...
And that was a live evidentiary hearing?
It absolutely was. Fairly involved, considering. With respect to the Lillian Castro, unless there are any other questions on that, the witness that was not allowed to be called, this case went on for 3 years. Mr. Terry waived it up back in, I think, I don't know, 3 years prior before going to trial to take a deal. We went through at least three other counsel. And quite frankly, you know, counsel was appointed because the client was difficult. I mean, it was one of those, he came in and wasn't getting along, so the PD was taken off the case, conflict counsel came in. Again, it was just a personality thing, but it delayed the trial for 3 years. There were at least five motions to continue, a couple because new counsel were put on, and at least three for out-of-state witnesses that were arising like right before trial. We get to calendar call, defense announces ready. We're all ready. We come, we're picking a jury, and then defense comes in and says, we need to move to continue for Lillian Castro. I'd been subpoenaing Lillian Castro for 3 years. I made a very clear record that she never really wanted to come. We were never pushing it because, quite frankly, everything that she was going to testify to would come in through other witnesses. She had babysitting issues. She had financial issues. She had some health issues. Never really anything egregious. Had I pushed her, my feeling was always I could get her here, but I didn't really need her. In any event, I had made a record of that before, and I made a record of that again when defense came in asking for a continuance.
Could you address the unavailability determination with respect to the investigator's testimony as to her statements to him?
She wasn't unavailable. She's specifically held to be unavailable if there's a reason keeping her from the jurisdiction, and more importantly, the party seeking to offer her makes reasonable efforts to obtain her and procure her attendance. They did nothing. They relied on the fact that she was on my witness list. She was never subpoenaed. There was never a motion filed. There was nothing ever done with respect to procuring her attendance. And the case law is very clear. If you don't at least subpoena and thereafter attempt to compel a witness who's out of the jurisdiction, then you can't possibly declare that she's unavailable. With respect to any other documentation, the court made a clear finding that it was unreliable, that you couldn't say that custody documents are reliable. I mean, that would be issues about custody. That's what the investigator was going to testify to. I mean, they're almost per se unreliable. I mean, it's probably the most suspect legal proceeding people have out there is when children are at issue. Beyond that, though, the uncontroverted testimony that came in this trial, even without Lillian Castro coming in, there was an ugly custody battle. This kid wanted to be back with her aunt back in Vegas with Lillian. Her dad was stealing her back from her. She was trying to run back. The child testified, I want to be with my aunt. The dad testified she wants to be with her aunt. I tricked the aunt. I took her and I kept her here. The uncontroverted evidence was there was a big custody battle. It was ongoing at the time of the disclosures. It wasn't concluded until after this was determined that there was a molestation and that the child wanted to be with the aunt. The dad didn't want her here. So to the extent that I guess it was a bias issue on behalf of the dad, although I'm not even sure how that fits, insofar as the dad wasn't the one that made the allegations. It was actually the stepmom that found the list by the child. One of the 10 reasons why it sucks to be me is because you're molested by your uncle in Vegas. I mean, this is the kid who testified. She wanted to be with her aunt. And her dad was pulling her away. So all of these, there's nothing that Lillian Castro could have or would have added to what already came in to more fully prepare a defense. It simply wasn't a defense that was going to rise above basically an admission by a defendant to molesting this kid. And regardless of where the child wanted to be, she came in and she testified accordingly. So even assuming she'd come in, even assuming we let the investigator testify, even assuming we let any court documents in, all they would have done is been cumulative of the other testimony that was already out there. We never raised an issue contrary. So, are there any other issues that?
Justice Gibbons, Justice Speaker?
Anybody?
Thank you, Ms. Holtz.
Thank you.
Rebuttal? You've got 2.5 minutes left.
Thank you, Justice. With regard to Ms. Holtz's statements about this being cumulative and the information that the defense was prevented from presenting to the jury, this right to cross-examine is not a substitute to right to call witnesses and present your full theory of the case. Mr. Kabeling was cross-examined, but the fourth assignment of error here is that defense counsel was limited by the trial court's decision on the cross-examination of Mr. Kabeling. It was stated very clearly that the document that was purported to be written by him would not be admitted into evidence, would not be allowed to be held up, and there would be no cross-examination beyond asking him, had he ever told anybody that his wife had died in a car accident? Now, the other testimony by Lillian DeCastro would have impeached that, and she would have been able to show that, in fact, he had. And again, it's not just his credibility at issue, but much more importantly, the bias. And his bias runs through the defense theory of the case. With regard to the unavailability, that argument here has to do with the specific section in which she was not available because of her cancer surgery the week before. And it's not the fact that defense didn't subpoena her is a limited utility here because there was no obligation to honor an out-of-state subpoena from a defense counsel. What he did was stay in contact with her, and his investigator only told him the day before the start of trial, she's not going to be able to testify. She's not going to be able to travel. And this is the situation that took place in Mulder 116 Nevada 1, and the lower court was found to have not been in error because in that case, the defense was asking for a 60-day continuance, which this court found was to be an unreasonable delay, and the defendant had refused to assist counsel there. This situation is quite different from that because the witness that was prevented from testifying was essential. The lower court here summarily stated that she's not essential. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. She was the only witness the defense would have had to call to testify about the countervailing position that was taken that she had in the custody determination. and would have provided also impeachment testimony, as well as her impression of the alleged victim here at the time that these allegations took place.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, the panel thanks both counsel for their arguments and briefs in this matter, and this case will stand submitted.